You started it. I played along. You thought I was big and dumb. You were only half right. Then be honest. You're not taking me to Andros. You're going to kill me here. No roll in the hay is worth $28 million. I could take you there and have you and the money. Paris didn't reply. But no, you're right. Kane raised his gun. You're not coming. Wait. Paris pointed to the crates in the cage. What if I could get you double that? Maybe more. I'm listening. Paris unbuttoned her blouse, lifted the hem, gripped it in her teeth, and pulled. She made a hole in the stitching and worked an object out through it. A memory stick. She passed it to Kane. What's this? A copy of the report. Exactly the same as the one Vidic had. I duplicated it in case the plan changed on the fly and I had to make the exchange. You said it couldn't be copied, like NFTs or whatever. We lied. Techno bullshit. We just made it look that way. We were bound to get found out eventually. But people didn't have to believe it forever, just long enough to write the check. And with this report, exclusivity isn't such a big deal. Loads of countries out there want it. I have Vidic's contacts. You could sell it again. Multiple times, if you want. So now I have the copy. Why do I need you? Because you can't open it. So you need to let me go. When I'm safe, I'll text you the password. That could work, I guess. The file is the same as Vidic's. Exactly the same. It is. In every way. Paris nodded her head. Including the password? Paris frowned. Kane smiled. He raised Ivan's phone and said, oops. Rachel spotted the landscaping van the moment their Uber pulled up outside the hangar. He made it immediately as the FBI surveillance vehicle. But unlike Vidic, he made no effort to avoid being seen. The bureau guys were going to get involved at some point. He saw no reason to stand in the way of the inevitable. The reception area was deserted when Reacher stepped inside. Knight followed. She looped around and checked behind the desk. Reacher opened the door to the hangar, and even before he went through, he could smell the blood. He stepped inside, saw the scale, the broken-down plane, the freight cages, and two bodies, Vidic's and Paris's. He crossed to take a closer look and saw both of them had been shot in the head, once each with a small-caliber weapon. Knight stayed in the doorway. She said, Reacher, that's a crime scene. Be careful. The agents from the van will be here any second. Reacher said, watch the door. Then went to search the bodies. When he was done, Knight came to join him. She said, anything? Reacher nodded toward one of the storage cages. That one's been used recently. It's the only one that's not locked. There's an empty pallet, a few shreds of packing straw. Someone cleaned it out. I can't find Vidic's phone. Everything else is normal, except for that. He pointed at the hem of Paris's shirt. They didn't shoot each other. Not with matching head wounds like that. No. Kane. Most likely. Why is Paris's shirt unbuttoned? Do you think he molested her? Maybe that's how it got torn. Doesn't look like the kind of tear you get in a sexual assault. Buttons torn off, yes. Sleeves, too. But the stitching on a hem? It's more likely she had hidden something there. Something small. A handcuff key, maybe. You think he cuffed her? There are no marks on her wrists. Something else, then. Maybe the lab techs will pick up some kind of residual. Knight looked toward the door. What's taking the agents so long? Do you think they're calling for backup? Maybe. I guess we should go and make contact. Make sure they know we're friendlies. Reacher closed the rear door and stepped away from the landscaping van. He borrowed Knight's phone and called Divine. He gave her the news. Two agents down, two suspects down, or three in one, given what they knew about Vidic, plus one suspect unaccounted for and an unknown quantity of gold missing. Not the kind of news she was hoping for, not with the PR issues she was dealing with. That was for damn sure. Reacher hung up and handed the phone back to Knight. She said, "You didn't tell Devine you'd recovered the memory stick. Want to call her back?" Reacher said, "No." "Why not?" "I don't know. Something in my gut told me not to. Maybe I will later. We'll see." "If you say so. What do you want to do now? It'll be better if we're not here when the circus arrives." What Reacher really wanted to do was head to the nearest Greyhound station or find a good spot to hitch a ride. But a nagging doubt stopped him. It had to do with the scene inside the hangar. He was missing something. He was sure of it. He just couldn't put his finger on exactly what. He felt like he was looking at a print from an instant camera before it had time to develop all the way. The picture was blurry. The key objects were out of focus. That would change, he knew it. But it would take time, and it couldn't be rushed. Reacher said, "How about we head to that hotel you found?" "The courtyard? That works for me." Knight opened her phone again and pulled up the Uber app. The hotel was a big, sprawling place, and the room Reacher and Knight were given was all the way at the end of a corridor on the second floor. It turned out to be more like a mini suite. Aside from the bedroom and bathroom, there was a kind of living room with a couch and a TV and a fridge and a microwave. Reacher took a seat on the couch. The air was cranked all the way up. That was a welcome relief from the damp heat outside. Knight poked around the room and then began to pace up and down, unable to stay still. Reacher said, "You okay?" Knight said, "No. How could I be? Think of everything that's happened in the last couple of days, all the shit we've been through. And I'm still no closer to catching Kane. In fact, I'm further away. I'm just so frustrated I want to smash something." "I get that. But Devine said your shield is waiting for you back home. Kane is on the FBI's radar now. He's tied into a case involving a rogue agent, a dead rogue agent. They're not going to rest until they find him. You can count on that. Maybe it's time to pass the baton, get back to your real life. Would you do that in my shoes?" "Hell no." "Well then." Knight kept on moving. There was a coffee machine on a counter above the fridge. Reacher moved closer to see how it worked. There was a little plastic drawer that pulled out. It held perforated sachets. It looked like it took one per serving. There were two, not including the decaf options. Reacher said, "Want a cup?" Knight said, "Caffeine? Me? Right now? Yes, Reacher. Great idea." Reacher picked up on the sarcasm and just made one cup. He carried it back to the couch. "Sorry," Knight said. "You hungry?" "I could eat." "What do you feel like?" "Anything." Knight took out her phone and looked for options. After a minute, she said, "Cuban?" "Sure." "Want to see the menu?" "Do they have a Cubano sandwich?" "Looks like it." "I'll have one of those. And a pan con bistec, no lettuce." Knight added a mango Caesar shrimp salad and a selection of mariquitas and placed the order. Then she started pacing again. The food came in 20 minutes. It was delivered right to their hotel room door. Knight took a towel from the bathroom, spread it on the ottoman, and laid out the styrofoam containers in a neat line. Neither of them spoke while they ate, but it wasn't a comfortable silence. Knight was on edge. She had nervous energy to burn. That was clear. Knight took a last bite of her salad and said, "I'm going for a walk. Want to come?" Reacher shook his head. "Have you got a computer with you?" "What do you want a computer for?" "I want to see what's on the memory stick." Knight pulled her laptop out of her bag and showed Reacher how to hook up the memory stick and select the document that was on it. A box appeared asking for a password. Reacher entered the string of characters he'd seen Vidic text to the guy's phone in the airport bathroom. He pecked away slowly with one finger, but he got the job done. The screen filled with words. Knight gave him a squeeze on the shoulder and made for the door. The document was nothing like what Reacher had expected. He was anticipating all kinds of technical drawings and jargon he wouldn't understand and data he couldn't interpret. What he found was a long, scholarly discussion on the history of atomic weapons. It went all the way back to the early days of the first research programs. It discussed reactor piles and heavy water manufacture and problems getting hold of sufficient uranium. Reacher found he was enjoying the material. He read fast, and his mind soaked up all the detail and the associated trivia. Then, when he was three-quarters of the way through, he stopped in his tracks. He had found out why the price tag attached to the report was so high. The section in question concerned the fissile material that was needed to create the enormous explosive power of the weapons, how it was made, and how it was formed to best facilitate the nuclear reaction. It turned out the United States favored a cone shape for the material, hence the company's name, Cone Dynamics. It was the leading specialist in the field. The analysis went on to detail how if the material degraded, the bombs would lose efficiency. If the degradation reached a certain level, they wouldn't function at all. The design of the U.S. architecture assumed a span of 100 years before this level would be hit. But there was a problem. The material was new at the time. There was no history associated with it, no experience to base the calculations on. The scientists had been forced to rely on projections, and the Cone Dynamics guys had discovered that these projections were wrong. The degradation occurred more quickly. The cone shape that had been adopted exacerbated the decline. The effective life wasn't 100 years. It was closer to 70. The bulk of the warheads in the U.S. missile systems had been built in the 1950s. Which meant that practically the whole of the nuclear arsenal was obsolete. If the weapons were fired, they would reach their targets. There was no problem with that. They might make a crater when they landed, but they would not explode. There would be no mushroom cloud, no heat, no windstorm, no radiation, and therefore no deterrent. The United States was vulnerable. In a way it had never been in its entire history. Chapter 36. Reacher read to the end of the report, then closed the computer and leaned against the back of the couch. He was trying to make sense of what he'd learned. The country's entire nuclear arsenal was inoperable, but did that matter? If an enemy nation discovered the secret, would they really launch an attack, safe in the knowledge that they wouldn't face any retaliation? It would be the end of mutual assured destruction. There was no doubt about that. Back in his army days, Reacher knew that people on the U.S. side had flirted with the idea of preemptive strikes, even knowing there would be a response. Credible intelligence suggested Soviet generals had done the same. There was speculation about the Chinese and all the non-state actors that kept popping up. That was all years ago, of course, but the world had only gotten crazier since then, and someone had just paid a prodigious amount of gold to get their hands on the report. Reacher was driving himself crazy with the speculation. He had no crystal ball. All he could say with certainty was the fewer people who knew the secret, the better. There was less chance of it leaking that way. Which led him to another question. Who already knew? Vidic and Paris had, for sure. But they couldn't leak because they were dead. Bowery might have known the details, but he was also dead. Divine and the team that had analyzed the memory stick from St. Louis would, if the document on it was the same. And Kane most likely would. He would have demanded details when Vidic proposed the trade for his life. The picture in Reacher's mind suddenly came into focus. The scene from the hangar. Two things now connected. Paris's torn shirt and Vidic's missing phone. The hole in the hem was the perfect size to conceal a memory stick, and the phone contained the password to open the report. Kane not only knew, he had another copy. He could put the report back on the market anytime he wanted to. Reacher picked up the room phone and called Divine. He gave his name and she came back with, "I'm busy, Reacher. Make this quick." He said, "You have another problem. There's one more memory stick. Kane has it." Divine didn't respond right away. Then she said, "And you know this how?" Reacher explained about the shirt and the phone. Divine said, "That's it? It's pretty thin, Reacher." "Maybe. But if I'm right..." Divine sighed. "I'll look into it." Knight let herself back into the room half an hour after Reacher finished his call. She walked over to the couch, slumped down in the spot next to Reacher, and closed her eyes. Reacher said, "Feeling any better?" She said, "No." "Did you read the report?"
"I did."
"Was it worth all the song and dance?"
"And some."
Knight opened her eyes.
"Really?
It's serious stuff. Want to take a look?"
"No. I have no bandwidth left for serious stuff."
"Okay, then." Reacher dropped the memory stick on the floor and crushed it with his heel.
"What did you do that for?"
"Like I said, it's serious. I'd trust you to read it, but no one else." Reacher and Knight slept in the same bed, but nothing happened between them. They didn't even touch. They were both too restless. And they were both awake when Knight's phone rang the next morning. It was Divine. Reacher answered. Divine said, "I'm just checking in. Yesterday was quite a day. Are you okay? Is Knight?" Reacher said, "We're fine. Specifically, I'm checking in about reporters. Bloggers, conspiracy nuts. Has anyone been in touch with you?"
"Do they count as nuts if what they think is true?"
"Whatever. Has anyone been sniffing around is the point."
"No one." "What about Kane?"
"We've located him. He's in the Bahamas. We can't do anything, unfortunately. He's in a sovereign nation and our case is just too weak."
"It's weak?"
"He killed two agents, three if you count Vidic, a retired detective, and that's before you scratch the surface."
"I was talking about our official position."
"Unofficially?" "People do all sorts of dangerous things in the Bahamas. Take scuba diving as an example. Equipment fails, air tanks run dry. Who knows? Maybe you'll read the paper on, say, next Thursday. Maybe there'll be a story about a fatal accident. Maybe you'll recognize the victim's name."
Reacher hung up and handed the phone to Knight. She said, "What was that about Kane?"
"They're running a black bag op on him. They're going to drown him next Thursday."
"Sweet. Fancy an island vacation? I'd love to be there when they bring the body in."
Reacher didn't reply. She said, "Sorry. I know your passport has expired. I didn't mean to be insensitive."
"It's not that. I'm thinking about the memory stick. Assuming Kane has it. If he's still breathing for another few days, that gives him plenty of time to set up a sale. The report is in demand. Look at how fast Vidic offloaded it. And Kane has Vidic's phone. He has access to his contacts. He could get in touch with the same folks that tried to buy it before, offer them a second bite at the apple, or find a new buyer, or hide it. Then someone might find it after he's dead."
"I see that.
What do you want to do about it?"
"Go to the Bahamas. Find Kane. Get it back."
"How?"
"Your passport is expired. Someone flew Kane there with a bunch of illicit gold, on short notice. Kane only got the address of the hangar an hour or so before we showed up. That person can fly us. I just need your phone again. I need to ask Walwork for two more favors."
Andrew McLeod, the pilot, lived alone in a V-shaped single-level home. It was at the corner of a triangular street, which was called a circle, about 5 miles away from the executive airport where his hangar was located. Most days he could drive to work in under 10 minutes, but that morning there was no point. His premises were closed by order of the FBI. The building was swathed with crime scene tape, and it was under 24/7 observation. McLeod was still in his bathrobe when the doorbell rang. He'd slept late. He was exhausted. The combination of lots of hours in the air and the shock of finding two dead bodies in his workplace. When he heard the sound, his first thought was reporters. He'd been warned not to speak to any. The FBI agent who had interviewed him had been clear on that point. But still, he was tempted. He wanted to see his name in the paper. More important, he wanted his ex-wife to see it. He crept toward his living room window, peeked out at his front path, and saw two people. A huge guy, not unlike the man he'd been forced to transport the day before, and a woman, quite similar to the one he'd seen dead on his hangar floor. He pulled away fast, and that was a mistake, because the movement caught the huge guy's eye. Reacher abandoned the bell and hammered on the door. He got no response. He hammered again, harder. There was still no answer, so he called out, "McLeod, we're coming in. There's nothing you can do to stop us. The only question is, are you going to open the door first?" 5 seconds ticked past, then Reacher heard footsteps. The door opened. McLeod stood at the threshold, trying to block the way. Reacher said, "Can you fly in that robe?" McLeod said, "No." "Then you better change." "Why?" "You flew a guy to Andros yesterday, in the Bahamas. You're going to take us to the same place." "I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't fly anyone anywhere yesterday. I couldn't. Some lunatic broke into my place. There was a shootout. Bodies on the ground. Blood. The FBI." "The guy who did the shooting. He gave you gold to fly." McLeod didn't respond. Reacher's statement wasn't technically true. One of the dead guys had given him the gold. Kane just took the ride the stiff had paid for. But McLeod didn't think it was the time to dwell on the details. Reacher said, "Tell me about flying. Do you like it?" McLeod nodded. "Do you need legs that work to fly? Arms?" McLeod changed into jeans and a Hawaiian shirt with shoulder tags to hold his captain's epaulets, then drove Reacher and Knight to the executive airport in his BMW. He parked two hangars away from his own, then led the way between a pair of buildings. They approached the apron where his planes were parked on foot. There were three aircraft clustered together. All were different models. Reacher recognized one kind. It was an ancient de Havilland, built in Canada for a few decades after World War II. The U.S. Army had used them for search and rescue missions. Reacher had been involved in a few of those, although in his experience, they generally wound up as search and recovery. McLeod crossed to the left-hand side of the de Havilland. He opened a small door and gestured for Knight to crawl through to the middle row of seats. Reacher looped around and got in at the front. McLeod circled the plane. He was serious about his pre-flight inspection, despite the illicit nature of the flight itself. He climbed in behind the yoke next to Reacher. Inside the plane, everything felt flimsy and worn. The seats were thin and the springs poked through the scant padding. Exposed metal was everywhere. All the signs and warnings had been applied with red paint, some freehand, some stenciled, several almost completely rubbed off. The same went for the calibration markings on some of the controls. Most of the instruments looked like they'd been stolen from a museum, although Reacher was surprised to see some modern ones shoehorned in, with digital readouts and color displays. McLeod took a headset that had been hooked over his front sun visor and put it on. It had a microphone sticking out at the side. He pointed to a set of ear defenders in front of Reacher's position and another on Knight's right-hand side. These were standard home improvement store items, hard and orange and plastic. Reacher and Knight pulled them on anyway. McLeod started the engine. The propeller turned erratically for a moment, then fell into a steady rhythm. McLeod spoke to the tower, then eased a lever forward. The plane started to move. The taxi out to the runway was bumpy, but not too loud. They trundled to the end, turned, and waited. Then McLeod opened the throttle. The plane shook and rattled and built up speed until it was able to claw its way into the air. McLeod held it straight, climbed, then pulled a tight 180-degree turn. Reacher could see a soccer stadium below them, a few wide, straight roads lined with businesses, residential streets fringed with neat square houses, many with pools, strips of water, taller buildings in the distance, including one that looked like the body of a giant guitar. The plane was soon out over the water. It settled into a steady drone. The sun was to their left, halfway up in the sky. Land appeared after a shade under a half hour. Andros Island. Reacher could see a sandy coastline. Occasional clusters of cabins on the beach. Boats moored just offshore. Several piers jutting out into the water like pointing fingers. Many had structures at the end. They were mostly made of rough wood with roofs thatched with palm fronds, though a few were more substantial. A wide river cut through the island at one point. Trees covered most of the land, except for a handful of deep, round holes that were filled with bright blue water. Their destination had been determined before leaving McLeod's house. Reacher had initially been in favor of going to the same landing strip that McLeod had taken Kane to the day before, but a problem had emerged. They compared the strip's position on the map with the location of Vidic's phone, which Walwerk had provided. The two did not match. The phone, and therefore presumably Kane, was about 10 miles from the strip. McLeod reported having seen no taxis or vehicles or facilities of any kind when he had deposited Kane and unloaded his crates of gold. The place sounded like a dead end. So they decided on the island's established airport instead, Fresh Creek. The landing was bumpy. The runway was rough. It was a series of concrete slabs set close together, but with definite gaps between them. McLeod bounced his way to the only building that was in sight, the terminal. A hand-painted sign announced its international status, but one of the screws holding it up had rusted through, leaving it hanging down at a drunken angle. Knight climbed out and walked toward the door marked Arrivals. She had her passport in her hand, and she moved slowly and calmly, like a regular tourist. McLeod swung the plane around. He guided it back along the runway all the way to the far end. He swung the plane around again. When it was side on to the terminal, Reacher opened the door. He slid out, dropped onto the ground, and rolled to the side. Then he scrambled up and darted into the belt of trees and shrubs that lined the site. McLeod rumbled the plane back toward the terminal. Reacher pushed his way through the undergrowth. He was expecting to find a fence to climb, but soon arrived at the side of a road that ran parallel to the runway. No cars were passing, no vehicles of any kind. No one had seen him. He glanced around one more time, then sat at the edge of the blacktop. Knight appeared after 10 minutes. She was in a taxi, an aged Nissan minivan. She was driving it. She had struck a deal with its owner to rent it for the day. She had offered $1,000. The woman hadn't taken much persuading. Her only condition was that Knight give her a ride home first, which was 5 minutes from the airport. When they pulled up outside her house, Knight struck another deal, $100 for the use of a pair of binoculars. Reacher climbed into the passenger seat. Knight didn't speak for the first few minutes. She was busy adjusting to driving on the left. It was the first time she'd ever done that. She pulled up a map on her phone and entered Vidic's location. It was 15 miles away. The roads were wide and generally straight, with a few tight turns and narrow bridges over rivers and streams. There was next to no other traffic, very few houses. The ones they saw were small and low, set back from the road, and mostly disappearing into the trees. A handful of new ones were under construction, all concrete and rebar. The sites were all fenced off, and no one seemed to be actively engaged in the process of building them. There were several churches, which looked to be in good condition, and numerous vehicles abandoned at the side of the road, which did not. There were trees everywhere, but not many flowers. When the phone's map said they were a quarter mile from their destination, it called for them to turn left toward the ocean, along a straight, narrow road. In reality, it was little more than a track cutting through a mangrove swamp. Knight stopped the cab. Reacher got out. He had the binoculars. He used them to observe the one building that was visible. It was ahead and to the right, but not on the land, not even on the beach. It was perched on the end of a pier, 30 yards from the shore. Three cars were parked at the water's edge. They were nondescript Japanese sedans, probably all that was available to rent or buy on the island at short notice. Reacher climbed onto the roof of the minivan to improve his vantage point. He lay flat and trained the binoculars on the building. It was the most substantial structure he'd seen on a pier, either from the plane or the taxi. It was an octagonal shape for optimal views of the island and the ocean. It was built of brick and stone, not wood. It had a tiled roof that was covered with solar panels, glazed windows, and a solid-looking front door. A deck ran all the way around it, edged with a rustic wooden railing. A ladder ran down to the surface of the water, and a boat was moored to one of the stone pillars that supported the house, a Zodiac, with twin outboard motors. It looked fast even when it wasn't moving. The pier led away from the center of a gentle cove, and the nearest points of land were symmetrical promontories, each about a quarter of a mile from the house itself. Reacher stayed on the roof for 10 minutes, then slid down and told Knight what he'd seen. She said, "What about Kane?" "He was there, and so were his four guys." Chapter 37 Reacher and Knight climbed back into the minivan and took a moment to assess their situation. The outlook was not favorable. They were outnumbered 5-2. Their opponents had a prime position. It had an unobstructed 360-degree view of its surroundings, and the only dry approach was along an exposed pier that offered no cover whatsoever. Reacher said the best approach would be a siege, all things being equal. Knight said, "We could do that. Keep watch. Stop anyone who tries to approach in case they're here to buy the memory stick. Then hand the gig over to the feds on Thursday." "True, but all things aren't equal. What if Kane emails the report to a buyer? What if the buyer shows up on a boat? How would we stop them? Or a float plane? Or a helicopter? Or Kane leaves on his boat? No, the only option is a deliberate attack." "That's impossible." "No, just difficult." "So what's the plan?" "Two phases. First, we reduce their numerical advantage. I want you to set a marker on this road. I'll hide in the mangroves at the side. There's plenty of room in their crazy routes. You continue. Drive all the way up to the parked cars. Then make a nuisance of yourself. Crash into one of the cars, maybe. Set its alarm going. Slash its tires. Make it look like you're going to steal it or light it on fire. Keep going till one of the guys comes running across the pier. More than one, if we're lucky. Then turn around and hightail it out of there. Don't stop till you reach the marker. The road's so narrow, they'll have to stop too. Get down in case they open fire. Then I'll hit them from the side." The least satisfactory part of the plan's execution, from Reacher's point of view, was the lack of visibility from his hiding place. He saw Knight drive away. Then he could only listen. The engine sound faded. A couple of minutes passed. Then he heard glass smashing, a car alarm blaring, more glass smashing. Then nothing for another 2 minutes. Three. Then he heard a vehicle approaching, but slowly, not trying to outrun anything. There was no doubt about that. Then the minivan trundled back into sight. Knight jumped out. She stood at the side of the road, hands on her hips, and said, "Sorry, Reacher. I did what I could. The fish didn't bite. Reacher emerged from the tangle of mangrove roots and stood by Knight's side. He said, no problem. Time for a new plan. Can you look up what time the sun will set tonight? Knight prodded and swiped at her phone, then said, a whisker after 7:30. Okay. That means we'll have to stick around a little longer than I'd hoped, but so be it. Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe they'll come out on their own. But because they probably won't, I want you to drive to the airport, go back through passports, find McLeod, and tell him to fly to this spot at exactly 7:20. Then it'll be time for him to channel his inner barnstormer. I want him to fly around like a maniac, pretend he's trying to land on the beach but keeps having to pull up, make it look like he's out of control, like he's going to crash, like he's drunk. He can do anything he wants as long as it's eye-catching. Okay? No problem. He needs to keep it up as wild as possible till 7:30, then return to the airport and wait for us at the far end of the runway, where I got out. There were 6 hours to kill before McLeod performed his tricks, and under different circumstances, it would have been pleasant to spend the time together. The landscape was beautiful. They enjoyed each other's company. Reacher and Knight talked about it. They were tempted, but in the end, practicality won. Neither of them knew McLeod. All they had learned so far was that he was happy to break the law, given the right incentive. Not something that built confidence in his reliability. He had promised to wait, but if he got cold feet and bailed on them, their plan would fall apart. There were no attractive alternatives. So Knight left right away. They figured that with her by his side, McLeod's backbone would grow a little thicker, and his appetite for taking the easy way out would become a great deal thinner. Reacher found another spot in the mangroves with a view along the whole length of the road and settled in for the duration. He would have preferred to be with Knight, but with that possibility off the table, he didn't object to waiting alone. Stillness bordering on the comatose was one of the two natural states that suited him. The other was explosive action. If the plan worked the way he anticipated, there would be time for that as well, after the sun went down. No vehicles drove toward the shore the whole time Reacher was watching the road. None drove away from it. Reacher heard no boats and no planes. So when the clock in his head hit 6 p.m., he was as sure as he could be that Kane and his guys were still holed up in the house at the end of the pier. He broke cover and made his way west along the edge of the swamp. He saw fish sheltering behind the mangrove roots, turtles going about their business, but no people. He covered the ground slowly and steadily and made it to the rocky outcrop overlooking the house with 20 minutes to spare. By 7:15, the sun had sunk low in the sky behind him. Reacher took off his shoes and socks. He tucked his passport, an ATM card, and toothbrush safely inside and weighed the shoes down behind a root with the clock. He moved into the cover of a large mangrove plant and stepped into the water. He lowered himself until he was submerged up to his neck, moving gently, causing no ripples. 2 minutes later, Reacher heard a plane engine. It was coming closer. He scanned the sky. He caught sight of a dot against the inky background. It grew larger. He recognized the shape. It was McLeod's de Havilland. The airplane was coming in hot. For a moment, Reacher thought it was going to crash into the ocean near the shore. McLeod turned at the last moment, banked hard, and began to climb. Reacher set out to swim. He cut through the water steadily, smoothly. He made no jerky movements, no splashes, no sounds. The plane buzzed the beach, west to east. Reacher kept swimming, stroke after stroke. The plane rose, then wobbled in the air like it was losing its invisible support. It fell, then leveled out. Reacher swam on. He pulled a little closer to the house on the pier. He kept on going. The plane kept swooping and diving and banking. Reacher pulled to within 100 yards of the house. 50, 20. The plane darted across the sky heading west, but this time it didn't pull up. It didn't turn. It kept going on the same heading. It grew smaller, then disappeared. Reacher was still in open water. He was completely exposed. If he was spotted, that would be the end. The worst shot in the world would have all the time he needed to hit the target. Reacher took a deep breath and ducked his head under the water. He let himself sink a couple of feet straight down like a falling rock. Then he kicked with all his strength. He stretched and pulled and hauled himself through the water. The sudden increase in effort set off an abrupt throbbing in his head. He couldn't see anything through the darkness. His lungs began to hurt, then burn. He forced himself to take one more stroke, two, then let himself float to the surface. He opened his eyes and looked around. He saw the underside of the pier. He was safe, for the moment. Reacher swam to the ladder. He grabbed hold with his right hand, pulled, and immediately let go. There was no strength in his wrist, only pain. It couldn't take his weight. He couldn't climb with one hand, and he couldn't get his feet on the lowest rung. It didn't extend into the water, which left him marooned. There was no way forward and no way back. Reacher took a moment to bring his breathing under control. The throbbing in his head had subsided a little, but it was still there. He ignored it and looked around. He focused on Kane's boat, the Zodiac. He pushed off from the ladder and swam across to its mooring line. He pulled himself up with his left arm. He slithered over the side and rolled onto the boat's slatted wooden floor. Then he moved to the stern. He stood up, stretched out, and closed his fingers around the vertical side of the ladder. He stepped onto the bottom rung and began to climb. He made it to the top. He paused. He listened. He heard a creaking sound, but not footsteps. He figured it was just the ladder binding against the stone column supporting the house. He risked a peek above the highest rung. He saw no one. He took another breath and scaled the last few feet until he was standing on the deck. He darted across and pressed his back against the blank wall between two windows. Reacher chose the window to his left. He crouched down and took a quick look through the glass. He saw a bunch of living room furniture, but no people. He looked again to be sure, then tried to take hold of the window frame. He couldn't get a grip. The paint was too shiny, too slippery, and his right hand was no help at all. The false start on the ladder had messed it up worse than it had been after the car wreck. So he stretched up to the top of the casement with his left. He heaved. He used all his strength but couldn't move it an inch. The frame was stuck solid. There were three more windows on the first floor. They were for the kitchen, a dining room, and a study. All the rooms were empty. All the windows were jammed. Reacher stepped back until he was leaning against the railing. He craned his neck to get a glimpse of the second floor. He could see another four windows. Three were dark. They had plain glass, and they were closed. One had frosted glass, and it was open a crack. Reacher climbed onto the deck rail and leaned forward to use the wall for support. He studied the stones it was made from. One stuck out a little farther than the others. It had a flat top. Reacher would have preferred a deeper ledge, but there was nothing he could do. It was the best available. He planted his right foot on top and tried to grip its edge with his toes. The stone was rough against his bare skin. He shifted his weight toward the wall, pushed down with his foot, and shot his left hand up, aiming for the windowsill. He grabbed hold of it. He spotted a tiny ledge for his left foot, moved his foot from the rail, gripped with his toes, pushed down, and at the same time shoved his hand through the open window. His fingers found the inside edge of the sill. He shifted his right foot up, pushed, levered the window up with his wrist to increase the gap, slid his forearm through. Then his useless right arm, his head, his shoulders, his chest. With each move, he walked his feet higher, shifting them from one joint or crack in the stone to another. Finally, he wriggled his body far enough through the window frame for gravity to stop fighting him. He slithered across the top of a toilet cistern, took a moment to regain his balance, and lowered himself to the floor. Reacher lay still. He listened. He heard nothing, so he got to his feet. He took a towel from a rack on the wall. He needed to dry his hair to stop water from dripping into his eyes. Then the door opened. A guy stepped through. His hands were on his belt, already loosening the buckle. He saw Reacher standing in front of him. He stopped dead. Then he raised both his arms and lunged forward, clawing at Reacher's throat. Reacher threw the towel in the guy's face and batted his arms aside. Then he grabbed hold of the guy's shirt. He pulled, adding to the guy's own momentum. He stepped to the side and pivoted, swinging his shoulders around to bring every ounce of centrifugal force to bear. Then he let go. The guy continued straight. He was out of control, like a falling down drunk. His arms were flailing like windmills. He was desperate to find anything to brace himself. The wall, the window frame, the toilet. But he missed every solid surface. His head disappeared out of the window. His body followed. His legs, his feet. Reacher heard a crash from below. He heard wood splintering, a long, drawn-out scream. Then, silence. Reacher rushed out of the bathroom. The corridor was empty. He turned left and dived through the first door he came to. It was a bedroom, small and sparsely furnished. He pressed back against the wall to the side of the doorframe. He heard footsteps on the stairs, two sets, running. They continued straight into the bathroom. Reacher looked around for anything he could use as a weapon. He saw a chair sitting in front of a vanity. It was made of wood. It was old, rustic. It looked sturdy, and its legs narrowed markedly toward its feet. Reacher grabbed the chair and made for the bathroom. The two guys had found out it was empty. They had turned around. They got to the doorway at the same moment as Reacher. They were rushing out. Reacher was charging in. He was holding the chair out in front, legs first. One caught the leading guy in the gut. Reacher pushed forward. The second guy was slow to react. He slammed into his buddy's back, pinning him like the meat in a sandwich. The chair leg pierced the guy's shirt, then his skin. He howled. Reacher pushed harder, driving both the guys back through the door. The chair leg bit deeper into the first one's abdomen. He screamed. Blood soaked his shirt and streamed down, staining the front of his jeans. Reacher kept on shoving. The second guy slipped. He fell onto his back. The first guy tumbled on top of him. Reacher let go of the chair, then stamped down onto its seat. Hard. Maybe harder than he should have. A shockwave ran all the way up from the sole of his foot to the top of his skull. He felt a jolt of pain, sharp and hot. His vision split into two identical images. They stayed separate for a moment, then reunited. Reacher saw that the chair leg had disappeared farther into the guy's gut. He twitched, then stopped moving. The guy on the ground struggled and wriggled and managed to shove the corpse off to the side. He flattened his hands on the floor, ready to push himself up. He wasn't done fighting. That was clear. So Reacher stepped around and stomped on the guy's throat. His larynx collapsed. He wheezed and gurgled and clawed at his neck. His eyes bulged. No air was getting to his lungs. He rolled over onto his front. Some kind of primitive instinct was coming into play. It was driving him to protect his wound, to shield his weakness while he searched for a last-ditch maneuver. It was unlikely that he would find a way back, but Reacher was in no mood to take chances. He slammed his heel down against the base of the guy's skull. He heard a crunch. The guy stiffened. His shoulder blades pulled back, then he flopped down face first. He twitched. Then he was still. Reacher heard a sound behind him, another set of footsteps on the staircase. He spun around and rushed out of the bathroom. Kane's fourth guy was running up the stairs, heading right for him. He had a knife in his hand. Reacher hated knives at the best of times, and at that moment, he was far from his best. The throbbing in his head had wound up a notch, and his vision was blurred around the edges, so he picked his moment. He tracked the guy's trajectory, stepped forward at the perfect time, and kicked the guy under the chin like a lineman looking to make his name at the Super Bowl. The guy's head snapped back a full 90 degrees. Reacher heard a crack. It was crisp and loud. The guy's neck was broken. There was no doubt about that. His body spun around, landed on its back, and slid headfirst all the way down to the bottom of the stairs. Reacher stopped and listened. The house was silent. The four guys were accounted for. The secondary players, as Knight had christened them. But there was no sign of Kane, and the front door was open. Reacher suddenly saw the potential flaw in his plan. He had done what he had described to Knight the day before. He had projected his own attitude onto Kane. Reacher stood and fought when he was attacked, no matter the circumstances, no matter the odds. There was no guarantee that Kane would do the same. If he ran, and he didn't take Vidic's phone with him, it would take one hell of an effort to find him again. All he had to do was cover the length of the pier. The same stretch of walkway that had made the house so hard to assault was now Kane's cakewalk to freedom. Reacher pushed the doubt aside, picked up a Ruger 9mm that the guy he'd impaled with the chair had dropped, and checked the rest of the second floor. There were two more bedrooms. Both were empty. There was no sign of Kane. No indication he'd ever set foot inside them. Reacher made his way downstairs. The treads creaked under his weight, but otherwise the house was silent. There was nothing to give away any hiding places. No sounds or misplaced chinks of light. Reacher stopped in the hallway. There were four doors. All of them were closed. That meant there were four chances to find Kane, and four chances to walk into a trap. Reacher called out, "Kane, you surprise me. Vidic said you were an asshole, a sociopath, a Neanderthal. I believed him. But when he said you were a coward, I thought he was wrong. I know better now. No wonder everyone laughs at you. You're a joke. You have a yellow streak that's fatter than your head, which is pretty extraordinary if you think about it." Reacher paused. There was no response. He wasn't entirely surprised, but at least he'd tried. Now there was no alternative. He checked each first floor room in turn, the kitchen, the dining room, the living room, and finally the study. There was no sign of Kane. Reacher felt his stomach grow tight. He thought of the memory stick falling into the wrong hands. The consequences could be unimaginable. And then there was Knight. She had been so sad the night before when the reality of Kane's latest escape had come home to roost. Each time he slipped through their fingers, it only hit her harder. Reacher shook off the negative thoughts and forced himself to focus. The boat was still there. He would have heard the motor if Kane had sailed away in it. That meant his only route off the island was by air. There were two options: the official airport at Fresh Creek, or the private strip Kane had flown into the day before. Knight was at Fresh Creek. She would stop Kane if he tried to leave from there, or she would die trying. Reacher was sure about that, which left the new strip for him to cover. He checked the pockets of the guy who was lying at the bottom of the stairs. He ignored the guy's wallet and a spare magazine, then found what he was looking for: a car key. He slipped it into his pocket and took a step toward the front door, then stopped. The door was standing open, like an invitation, like someone wanted him to walk through. Reacher went back to the living room, unlocked the window, and climbed out. He glanced at the body of the guy who'd walked in on him in the bathroom. The top of the railing was gone, presumably into the water, and two of the uprights had speared the guy's torso. Reacher looked away, checked the Ruger, and started to edge around the building. He was moving clockwise, expecting to find Kane lying in wait beside the front door. His sight was still grainy, so he decided to take no chances. He would shoot Kane in the leg, the first chance he got. He made it halfway around, heard a thumping sound behind him. Then something slammed into him. It felt like he'd been hit by a truck. The impact knocked him down. He hit the deck. The gun slipped out of his grip, skittered across the deck, and fell into the water. The air was driven out of his lungs. His damp clothes were slippery, and he slid into the railing. His head hit a post, and his vision split in two. A wave of dizziness washed over him, just like it had done after the car wreck. Then he heard a voice. He realized it must be Kane's. It said, "You're clever, Reacher. Just not clever enough." Reacher rolled to the side and Kane's boot smashed down onto the spot where his head had just been. He scrambled to his feet and dodged backward, struggling for balance. Kane was looming in front of him, arms wide, blocking his path. He took a step closer. There was no way past him. He was the same height as Reacher, but he was heavier. He didn't have a cast on his wrist, and he could see straight. Reacher looked up and said, "You're the one who's not clever enough if you're thinking about killing the guy who wants to make you rich." Kane took another step. Reacher said, "You don't know who I am. I work for..." "It doesn't matter. The name wouldn't mean anything to you, but the money will." Reacher moved his left foot slowly to the side. Kane would be in range very soon. He would only have one chance to spring forward and poleaxe the guy, even though he could currently see two of him, so he needed to get his foundation just right. He said, "The gold those Europeans gave Vidic, that's peanuts next to what I can get you." He felt something against the side of his foot, something hard with a straight edge. "Why do you think I'm here? Why do you think I went to the trouble of infiltrating your tedious little group?" He glanced down. It was a strain to focus, but he was able to make out that the deck plank had snapped where Kane had stamped on it when he tried to crush Reacher's head. The rows of screws showed it had been fixed down at its front end, its center, and its rear end. Now it was broken between its center and its rear edge. "We knew all about Paris and Vidic and their little hacking sideline. Truth be told, we were impressed. They got some good stuff. Like the example you have. I hope you've got it somewhere safe." Kane's gaze dipped for a moment toward his right-hand pocket. Then he looked up and said, "I like you, Reacher. It's a shame I'm going to have to kill you. But you're bullshitting me. Vidic was a fed. You got wrapped up in this whole thing by mistake." Reacher said, "Kill me? You'll have to catch me first. I hope you can swim." Reacher fainted to the side like he was going to jump over the railing. Kane lunged forward. Reacher stamped on the broken plank, just ahead of where it was cracked. His weight forced that section down. The joist in its center acted like a pivot. The front end shot up right as Kane reached it. He tripped and went down face first. He lay still for a moment, winded. Reacher didn't hesitate. He didn't waste time on taunts or insults. He just curled his toes up and smashed the ball of his foot into Kane's temple. He did it again to be safe. Kane was completely inert. The back of his neck was exposed. Reacher raised his foot high. He was ready to slam his heel down and mash the delicate vertebrae, just like he'd done to the guy in the bathroom. Then he heard a voice. It was female. It was loud and insistent. It said, "Stop! Please!" Chapter 38. Reacher looked up. He saw two versions of Knight standing at the side of the house next to the railing. He blinked one copy away and saw that her eyes were wide. She was breathing hard. She said, "Don't kill him. He needs to stand trial. Everyone should know what he's done. He should pay the price the legal way. That's what my father would have wanted. I know that now." Reacher lowered his foot, then crouched down and checked Kane's pockets. The first was empty. There was a bunch of coins in the second, and a memory stick. Reacher pulled it out. He set it down on the deck, took the gun from Kane's waistband and used the butt like a hammer. He smashed the memory stick and swept the broken fragments into the water. Then he steadied himself, straightened up, and looked at Knight. He said, "Go ahead. He's all yours." Agent Devine was waiting in the little customs and immigration area at the Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport when Reacher and Knight got there. She had sent two agents outside to arrest McLeod, and two more to accompany Kane to the hospital and secure him there. Knight stepped up to the desk when she was called by the officer. She showed her passport, answered a couple of questions, and was allowed to formally re-enter the country. Devine waited for the glass doors to slide closed behind her, then turned to Reacher. She said, "So, the Bahamas. Do you think Kane wanted to retire to the beach and count his gold? Or is there some other attraction to the place? I've never been." Reacher kept a neutral expression on his face. It could have been a genuine question. It could have been an attempt to kickstart some small talk. But he figured it was more likely that Devine was trying to find out if he had read the Cone Dynamics report. The information it contained could conceivably lead to a nuclear attack against the United States. If that happened, some place upwind of the radioactive fallout would be the best location to hunker down. And if the world economy was decimated in the aftermath, there would be no better currency than gold. Reacher said, "I have no idea. I doubt Kane did either. Vidich picked the location. He found the house, the landing strip. It was all Vidich's plan." Vidich. Albatross. Whoever picked that cover name must have been able to see the future. I'm glad Vidich is out of the picture, but I'm not going to lie. Things would be a lot neater if you'd finished Kane as well when you had the chance. Reacher said, "Knight wanted her father's killer to stand trial. I guess I'm just a romantic at heart." "This isn't romance. This is a mess. If Kane goes to trial, there's no doubt he'll play for a deal. He'll threaten to spill what he knows to the press, and once we start down that road, it's only a matter of time until something leaks." "You said, if he goes to trial." Devine didn't reply. Reacher said, "Jails are depressing places. People get suicidal thoughts. Sometimes they act on them. Maybe I'll be reading a paper one day soon. Maybe there'll be a story about how Kane hanged himself in his cell. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've read that story before. More than once. Just with different names." Devine said, "I couldn't comment on that." Then she lowered her voice. "I think it's more likely that Kane will need surgery due to his head injury. He won't make it off the table. A tragedy, yes, but so commonplace it won't even make the papers." Then she turned to the officer and flashed her badge. This man's passport was destroyed during an official bureau operation. Any follow-up, send it to me. Reacher and Devine walked side by side toward the glass exit doors. They were frosted, but Knight's silhouette was still easily recognizable. Devine stopped. She said, "You go ahead. There's something else here I need to deal with. Goodbye, Reacher, and good luck, wherever the future takes you." Devine turned and made her way back to the immigration desk. Reacher stepped forward. The doors slid open and he walked outside. Knight moved over to stand in front of him. She pulled something out of her purse, a felt-tip pen. Then she took Reacher's right hand and lifted his arm until his wrist was horizontal. His fracture had been reset at a clinic in Androstown before they left the island. It was encased in regular plaster of Paris this time. Old school, plain white, and itchy as hell in the heat. Knight started to write on the rough surface. She set out a string of digits, 13 altogether, followed by an X and an O. She said, "That's an ISBN number. You can use it to identify a specific book. I would have ordered a copy for you online, but I didn't know where to send it. Maybe you'll pass a bookstore on your travels. If you do, buy a copy. You'll need it." Reacher said, "What for?" Knight dropped the pen back in her purse and took out a piece of folded paper. She handed it to Reacher. He straightened it out. It was covered with more numbers, all grouped together in sets of three. Reacher said, "It's a book code?" "I put it together last night at the hotel, when it turned out it was too late for the plane to take off. I wanted to say a few things, but I was having a hard time getting my words straight. It's about my father, about Cain, about you helping to catch him, and not killing him when I asked you not to. How I feel about all of that. The code seemed like a good way to do it. That way you can't read it right away. It's still a little raw for me, and it's not like I can email you later. There's a great bookstore in New Orleans. I'll hit them up the minute I get to town. Do that. And, Reacher, there's one other thing in there. My phone number. If you're ever near Phoenix, use it. When we met, I tried to bring you a fake breakfast as a trick. One day, I'd like to buy you one for real. This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of In Too Deep, a Reacher novel by Lee Child and Andrew Child. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer Kelly Gilday. Edited by JSR Post, LLC. Text copyright 2024 by Lee Child and Andrew Child. Production copyright 2024, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.